much. Okay, so this talk is about ELISA interferometer and its potential concerning constraints on cosmology. Just two words on the observational scientific context concerning gravitational waves in cosmology. So, okay, as you all know, we have direct gravitational wave detections. They have proved that we have now a new observable to probe the universe. And actually, there was also a couple of years ago this coincident detection of gravitational waves and electromagnetic emission. And this proved that the gravitational waves do have the potential to constrain cosmology, because this was used, for example, to measure the Hubble factor, but also to measure the difference between the speed of gravitational waves and the speed of electromagnetic waves, and to put stringent constraints on modified gravity theory, in particular some classes of theories that were used to really accelerate the expansion of the universe. So you see that, you know, already with just one event, we were able to put interesting constraints on the cosmological effects or cosmological parameters, let's say.
Can I just ask you that?
Please.
I don't know if you know about this or not. I mean, so this bound of alpha t less than 10 to the minus 15, which is incredibly strong, is our understanding of neutron star mergers good enough to know that we know precisely when light's emitted compared to long gravity?
I think yes. I think yes. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure, I mean, I'm not able to go into the details, but I think that the bound takes into account whatever theoretical uncertainty is there. So, okay, so to this picture that is built now with Earth-based gravitational wave detectors, we will soon add LISA, so in around 2032-2034 is the launch date. Then there is going to be other 2 years to get into the right orbit, so something between middle of 2030s, we might start to get LISA data. And as we detailed, LISA will open up a new frequency range in gravitational waves detection, which is between around the 100 Hz, which is the one of Earth-based interferometers, and the 10 to the minus 9 Hz, which is the one of pulsar timing arrays. And this new frequency range, it will obviously increase our knowledge about the gravitational wave spectrum, but it also has in itself some good potential for cosmology, as I will try to convey with this talk. Okay, so here is a bit the landscape. Before was the general context. This is really the context specifying on gravitational waves. So here we have the gravitational waves energy density as a function of frequency. And so these curves here are the constraints that can be put using CMB, so indirect measurement of gravitational waves through the B-mode polarization of the CMB, or even temperature, actually, anisotropies. This is what has been done by Planck. And you see future satellite like BERT, which is now, I think, on a very good path. It is going to be launched, 10 years, is it? 2028, so you see about 10 years scale. So it will get down of, you know, a couple of order of magnitudes. And so this is a bound, obviously, at very low frequencies, because this is the scale that enters the horizon at matter radiation equality, and this is the horizon scale today. That's what CMB can do. Large frequencies for the gravitational waves. Here the blue lines are pulsar timing arrays. So this is the international pulsar timing array, and this is whatever possibly we will be able to do with the SKA, that will observe many more pulsars and for a longer time. So go down up to 10 to the minus 14 or 15 in omega. And the frequency is a characteristic frequency to which you observe, you keep track of these pulsars, so the order of 10 years or so. The green lines here, these are Earth-based interferometers, so you have Advanced LIGO in Virgo, and this is a predictive sensitivity of a third generation Earth-based, like the Einstein Telescope or the Cosmic Explorer. So here they operate at a higher frequency, which is more or less set by the length of the interferometric arm. And LISA will detect in this frequency range around, let's say, the millihertz, frequency. So it is actually, so the advantage of going to space, obviously, there is no seismic noise, which is what is basically causing this wall here, right? At low frequencies on Earth, we are bound by the presence of seismic noise. And obviously, you can have much longer arms than on Earth, which also shifts you down to this frequency range. Which, by the way, was initially chosen because, as we will see, there is a big target there, which is massive black hole binaries. So binaries of black holes that reside in the center of galaxies, 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 7 solar masses. This is the source that will have the highest signal-to-noise ratio in LISA, and this source emits precisely, you know, if they have around 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 solar masses, emits in this frequency range. Just as, you know, the black holes of a few tens of solar masses emit in the LIGO band. So basically, this was the two reasons to go to space, also to be able to catch these kind of sources, very massive black holes. So the frequency range of detection of LISA is between 10 to the minus 4 Hertz and 1 Hertz. And the configuration is the following. It is three satellites that are put on an orbit around the Sun, following the Earth. And the length of the arm is 2.5 million kilometers. And each arm is constituted of two lasers, one going and one coming back for the interferometric measurement. So we have effectively three interferometers, which are not independent, though, because they share a common arm. And this kind of redundancy is there to allow, first of all, if one arm breaks, since you are in space, you cannot repair it, at least you still have the other two. But for other reasons as well. So in each spacecraft, there are two masses in free fall. And what we look for on the 2.5 million kilometers arms is picometer displacement of the masses. So this is the chronology of the mission, cutting everything that came before, because I think LISA was first proposed in the late 80s or so. But the first milestone was in 2013, when ESA selected the scientific team which was attached to LISA, namely the Gravitational Universe, for the mission that was going to fly in the L3 spot, which is Large Mission 3, which basically sets the date of early 2030s for the launch date. But this was just a selection of a scientific team. Actually, what really pushed LISA forward was the excellent results of the LISA Pathfinder that fell in 2016-2017. So the LISA Pathfinder is a satellite in which there is basically one interferometric arm of LISA squeezed just in one spacecraft. And it demonstrated the feasibility of LISA, meaning that it demonstrated the fact that it's possible to put these masses in free fall with a residual acceleration which is low enough to perform the interferometric measurement to the level which is required for LISA. And then, so the LISA mission was finally approved in beginning of 2017. So since then there was a phase zero study, but now we are undergoing this phase A study, which is basically when ESA really settled down the instrument configuration and discussed with these industries to sign the contracts to build the interferometers. The interferometer. We also had the reboot of the LISA consortium, which is now pretty big, more than 1,000 members. So we expect that the real construction of the mission will start in around 2022 for a launch, as I told you, 2032-34. The cost of the mission is 1,000 million euro and duration 4 years. Possibly with a 10-year extension. This duration, for example, is very important for what concerns detecting stochastic backgrounds from the early.
So this different in the launch date that you were mentioning?
It's
not really so clear. It's
not so clear because you see, so they count 8.5 years of construction starting from mission adoption, so it could be from 2030, but then they always allow for some years of, there is never a space mission which is in advance.
But whoever has to give the final word at ESA, if everything is ready to launch it in 32 instead of 34?
So I think this depends on this date. Whenever there is going to be mission adoption, afterwards, the launch date is going to be settled. Yeah, but we are yet not there, so.
So it hasn't been adopted
yet? Yeah, so it. So mission adoption, indeed, this is ESA wording. It means from now on we are going to construct it. Okay, so there is funding for LISA, and LISA is going to fly. This is what has been decided in 2017. But then it takes a few years, they have to sort out all the details and they have to talk about to the industries who have, the materials, how the spacecraft is assembled, all these things. And they have to
out of curiosity, since you alluded to it before, how important is the number of arms? Because I'm just thinking it takes 3 satellites to make 3 arms. If you put a fourth one, you would have 6 arms. So just out of curiosity,
obviously, the more arm you get, the better.
I know,
for
but
us.
Quantitatively, what does it do?
It improves, for example, the detection of the polarization. Because you can you have much more dependence on the direction of the gravitational waves. It improves the sensitivity because you will, in that case, you might have one interferometer with independent noise with respect to the other. So, adding another arm, then the problem is you need to get stable orbits. Okay, and I think that the reason why you cannot put a fourth spacecraft is that you don't know in which orbit to put it. So. These orbits need to be there. So, for example, the reason why you cannot extend for more than 10 years is that because after that, the orbits are not stable and the satellites drift. So you cannot, they don't find each other any longer. So I know that one of the problems is really to get to the right orbit. And the fourth spacecraft does not fit that. Okay, so what I will be... talking about here is results that have been obtained in the context of the LISA Cosmology Working Group. Which is the working group within the LISA consortium, which has the goal to investigate the scientific return of LISA in relation to cosmology. And I am coordinating this working group with Robert Caldwell and Germano Nardini. We have organized a lot of meetings, one school, etc. And so, there are projects that are going on within the cosmology working group, and we have papers. So I will present these results. Some of these results. Okay, so basically, I would like to convince you that LISA has a great potential to probe cosmology. Okay, this word "great" then depends on how you like it. Let's be optimistic. And there are, it is basically two, let's say, contexts in which LISA can help. So, in the context of the very early universe, by detecting the stochastic gravitational background from sources in the primordial universe. And this, of course, as we will see, so it provides, could provide, if we have detectable sources, exceptional tests of the early universe and in terms of high energy phenomena, high energy physics, at scales higher than whatever is probed by colliders. And then the other part is really the possibility of using gravitational wave emission from binaries to probe the late time dynamics of the universe and its content. So here is what we refer to as standard silence, you might have heard.
But so late is relative, right? I mean, it almost goes back to where the other way circulates in the world.
It almost, no, okay, for standard silence, if you say that you need an electromagnetic counterpart, you get to redshift 6,
That's almost realization, so.
Okay, so here I'm, but here I mean.
So you can understand what you mean by the left circle, I'm just saying the other one, really, you cover a fair amount of,
so you cover the whole universe.
It's true. It goes up to, I don't know where you want to put redshift 7.
It would be really nice if it was
your tools.
I should extend.
Just cut it off.
But I think this one, conversely, you see, this one should be made shorter.
Yeah.
Because this is really just up to 100 GeV or so. No, maybe, okay, so in the context of the early universe, so the work that has been ongoing in the cosmology working group is really twofold. So on one side there is the prediction of the stochastic signal, and on the other side is to develop detection techniques to detect this stochastic gravitational wave background with LISA, and in particular so the parameter estimation of the background for ground analysis, etc. So I will now concentrate on this, so on the early universe, and we will see the late universe later on. So this is just a cartoon for you to keep in mind why gravitational waves can actually be extremely useful for cosmology, provided we do have sources. So if you imagine that here we have time time increasing, and so temperature or energy scale decreasing, right? So what we know of the universe, of course, goes up to the MEV with big binuclear synthesis, and of course we know about inflation, not really so we have an upper bound to the inflationary scale with the CMB anisotropies. So if one say that this scale is 10 to the 16 GeV or smaller, obviously, but still you see there is a great range of scales of which we have no access through electromagnetic radiation because photons are tightly coupled. But gravitational waves are not. So if there is sources of gravitational waves going on in at these energy scales, that they emit something that it is visible, strong enough to be visible, then you know we have a direct handle on whatever is happening here. And we do expect interesting phenomena to occur here: reheating, biogenesis, phase transition, generation of dark matter candidates, etc. And as we will see, each gravitational wave detector can be bound to, so following its frequency range of sensitivity, can be bound to a particular epoch in the early universe. Okay, so this just repeating what I said, the gravitational waves in the early universe can be used as a probe of high energy physics because gravity is weak, gravitational waves propagate freely through the universe, which is, of course, the problem why it is so difficult to detect them. So it is good and bad at the same time, right? And I would say, so my view is really that the potential of gravitational waves to improve our knowledge of the universe is comparable to the one of the cosmic microwave background and at its door. We don't know whether a signal is there yet, but if it is there, you know, we can get a lot of information out of it. Now, exactly, so the question is, do we expect actually the presence of sources? And in particular, sources providing a signal which is high enough to be detectable. Okay, so let me just fix some notation. So what are gravitational waves in the universe? So the universe, so we assume a Friedman metric. Gravitational waves are then perturbations on this otherwise homogeneous and isotropic metric that are transverse and traceless. And then if you put this perturbed metric into Einstein equations, what you get out is a wave equation for the tensor perturbation. And we can have two ways in which the tensor perturbation is generated. So the first one is sort of passive, I would say, because here there is no source. And even if there is no direct source of the tensor perturbation, one can get a stochastic gravitational wave background during inflation because of the amplification of vacuum fluctuations. So it is, you know, the amplification of the metric fluctuation due to the accelerated expansion of the universe during inflation. However, so this is something I'm sure you're all familiar with. On the other hand, we can also have the presence of an active source of gravitational waves in the early universe. And this is the tensor anisotropic stress, so the part of the energy momentum tensor that is transverse and traceless, so it couples to the tensor mode. So what could be a source of tensor anisotropic stresses in the early universe? I'm giving here three possible examples that we will see can occur. So first of all, one could have chaotic distribution of bulk velocities that arranges in some way to get a tensor component. One could also have the presence of electromagnetic fields that by themselves have a tensor component in their energy momentum tensor. Or one could have a scalar field which is not homogeneous and isotropic but has spatial gradients. And this is as well can arrange so to provide a tensor mode.
I guess that term delta IJ, you don't want it there, not for nothing.
This one it does not contribute, yeah, indeed. So here I'm not putting the tensor component. Here I'm just putting the IJ component of the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so fair enough. This is all nice, but can we actually have something? And the answer is we don't know because this is all physics beyond the standard model, obviously. So there is a lot of room for speculations. And And therefore a great potential to test. So one thing that we know is there for sure is the stochastic background by second order scalar perturbations. But we can also have, so here I'm describing the mechanisms which are related to inflation, okay? So we could also have, you know, if we go beyond this the stochastic background I was telling you about, generated by the amplification of vacuum, metric vacuum fluctuations, and therefore we go beyond the standard slow roll inflation, one could, you know, think about a few mechanisms that produce can produce a stochastic gravitational wave background visible by present interferometers. Or we can also have something, but in general not visible, just after inflation in the phase in which you reheat the universe. This is, I would say, a quite fair a list of sources related to inflation. And a little bit later on, so in the radiation dominated phase, one could also have other kind of active sources of gravitational waves, first order phase transitions if they occurred, and the presence, possible presence of topological defects.
Here, about the spectator field, do you expect something specific for gravitational waves?
Well, I think it is quite speculative, but you could have. You
in the second order?
It is, yeah, you could have always second order perturbation that makes a bump. You could have it could be similar to particle production during inflation, right? It's the same thing. You can put whatever scalar field there or vector field, and it will act as a source of gravitational waves. Okay, so why do we expect a stochastic background from the early universe? The reason is very simple. So I'm now talking specifically about this kind of generation mechanism in which you have an active source, which then, so not the usual inflation case. In this case, you are bound by causality, right? So the source cannot operate beyond the horizon, and clearly when you observe today, you see the superposition of the production of gravitational waves by many uncorrelated horizons, and so you see effectively the signal from many independent sources. And therefore, what you get is a stochastic background. If we had a detector with an amazing resolution that could pick out, this angular scale, then we could actually see something more deterministic. But for the early universe, this angular scale is absolutely out of reach. So effectively, a stochastic background. Okay, so here you see we select a given scale, so we can associate to it a given frequency for our gravitational wave spectrum. So typically this is the frequency, the characteristic frequency of the spectrum. This can be at most, I would say, equal to the Hubble scale. So it is equal to the Hubble scale at the time the source, or at the temperature the source is operating, or it can be larger. It can be larger because causality can operate on a smaller scale here, clearly not on a larger scale, but on a smaller scale. So there is put for now just this parameter epsilon that depends on the detailed dynamics of the source, which is basically just connected to the characteristic scale of the tensor stresses. It could be a length scale or a time scale of the tensor stresses. And then this relation here, you just redshift it. And you find that you know this is the typical frequency of the spectrum today that you expect today, And it is, you can put it in correspondence with the temperature in the early universe at which the source is operating. Which means that I can build this kind of plot in which here then you have the frequency of the gravitational waves. And here we have an energy scale in the early universe. The black line is the relation I just showed you. And so each gravitational wave detector has associated to it a given frequency range in which it can detect. And so with this relation, we can make it correspond to some energy scale in the early universe. And if you look at LISA, you can see something, you know, which is of the order 10 to the 3 GeV, to the 4, to the 5 GeV. Okay, so it is an interesting scale that you can prove.
So, can you comment sort of on what they expect for epsilon star?
Epsilon is smaller than 1, for sure, and then it depends.
In the previous slide, we had something like 10 to the minus 5, so I'm wondering if I know.
Here we don't have 10 to the minus 5, here epsilon is here. 10 to the minus 5 is due to the expansion of the universe.
Oh.
Epsilon is here.
Okay.
I didn't specify it.
Okay, I thought you would just put it there as like a ballpark.
No. I don't want to give a ballpark because
okay.
It is really source dependent. It would correspond to this beta over H, for example, in phase transitions. We will see that later on. Okay, so and just what I wanted also to point out is you see CMB probes around here, BBN, so in principle, at least in principle, gravitational wave detectors give us the possibility to open up new energy scales to be probed. Okay, so now I will just go through a few of the sources that I mentioned. Just to give you flash some examples, I'm not going into any detail actually. But this is the signal from that you expect from slow roll inflation. Okay, so if you remain with slow roll inflation, obviously the tensor spectral index is related to the epsilon parameter, and so it is very small and negative. Which means that if I put this signal on this plot here with omega gravitational waves, so the energy density versus the frequency. This is whatever CMB is probing, and then if I extend this relation to for many orders of magnitude, to many scales, many range of scales, and it is just you know slightly red. And it is out of reach of any present and future gravitational wave detector. So what you need to do for this model is to find, to go beyond a simple slow roll scenario and find a way to enhance the spectrum. So I give just one example, which is if you have this kind of operator in your Lagrangian, if your inflaton is a pseudo-scalar, this is the energy scale that you can choose, more or less. And then this particular term in your Lagrangian means that you are coupling your pseudo-scalar inflaton to some gauge field, which is there. And then this gauge field will act, will produce a pi ij, so a tensor anisotropic stress, and will act as an active source of gravitational waves. And as a result, you could enhance the tensor spectrum of gravitational waves at high frequency. Okay, you expect also other signatures from these scenarios, non-Gaussianity of the gravitational wave spectrum and chirality, which could help you distinguish whatever you are seeing. And if one wants to be completely agnostic, the situation is very simple, as you can see. Here we have tensor to scalar ratio in inflation, and this is the tensor spectral index, and basically all this is the region that LISA can see for a pivot scale of CMB. it is not very interesting. You see, we need something very extreme, but you know, here is one example that you can actually achieve it. Okay, going to phase transitions now. So as you
extended it to multi-field inflation, would that change this very much? Hybrid inflation or something like that?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, here really the gravitational reproduction is from the gauge field. So, you know, it is the, so once you are, so what you need to couple the gauge field to your inflaton in order for it to be amplified, otherwise you have conformal invariance and you don't. Okay, then of course, yeah, absolutely. Then it's another kind of mechanism, but for sure. If you have defects, yes.
Right. Yeah, but I'm not sure what you have in mind, but if you think about the transition energy with a very high frequency endpoint, no?
I'm just thinking of the top rolling down, the side of the scale of one, it triggers the waterfall field, which could be a remote field.
Yeah.
Or,
but you would activate it.
This is on very small scale.
This is on very small scale, very high frequencies.
Hyperinflation, you can push the energy scale down, right? So I think you can push it towards. It's a numbers game, but you can make hyperinflation very low scales.
If you push it to around the electroweak scale, then you get something around
right.
Here. But
it is completely fine tuned.
The good part about this is that this is not really very much fine tuned. So if the inflaton is a pseudoscalar, you do expect this kind of terms of symmetries. And here you produce, if you assume that the coupling is there for the entire duration of inflation, you produce gravitational waves whenever this guy, the perturbation of the gauge field, enter the horizon. So you have a continuous production of gravitational waves, which is, you know, why you have this extended signal in frequency.
So is the take-home message that if the inflaton isn't coupled to the gauge field, we're not
going
to see
any. No, because you see there are other. Okay, so this is one possibility, okay, to get something. You have some particle production. Could be a scalar particle, a gauge field. The scalar particle has to be then non-homogeneous, or you need to have second order effects. So this is one possibility. You can have spectator fields, as we just discussed. You can have something which is, okay, a bit more speculative, but you can have, you know, so break the homogeneous and isotropic symmetry for the inflaton. This would also give a visible spectrum. You can have the presence of a graviton which is massive gravity during inflation. Or different speed of light just during inflation, all these kind of, okay, and the nicest one, I think, is beside this one, the other nice one is primordial black holes. So all these scenarios give you something which is can be visible by LISA, for example. Of course, you have to tune the parameters, but there is space for to get, you know, to test nice things. This was just one simple example to show you. Chris? So for example, in the case of LISA, there is one very interesting thing concerning primordial black holes. So this would be, you know, in order to get primordial black holes, you need to have a bump in the scalar spectrum that enhances the perturbation, the normal scalar perturbation level, right? So once you enhance the level of the curvature perturbation, you obviously enhance also the second order perturbation, which produces tensor modes. Okay, so it means that you have together with the production of primordial black holes, but somehow independent, as a side effect, you can have gravitational waves from second order. Okay. And if you do this, it has been calculated that the signal the signal is visible, this signal could be visible by LISA if the primordial black holes are in the range of mass which is 10 to the minus 13 solar masses, so very small, okay? But this is the only range which is still allowed for them to be the totality of dark matter. Is it clear what... So you might know now there is this an exclusion plot of all the primordial black hole masses, whether or not they can account for the totality of dark matter, and there is a lot of exclusion, microlensing, CMB, etc., and there is a sweet spot in which it is still allowed for the black hole to primordial black hole to be the totality of dark matter, and this spot. If there are primordial black holes with that mass, they would provide a stochastic background visible by LISA through second-order scalar perturbations. So this is very nice because it means that LISA, in principle, can test the hypothesis whether primordial black holes are or aren't the totality of the dark matter.
So just a comment that earlier on in this workshop, the conference, there were talks where actually the black hole, the
allowed
region actually is larger.
It's larger because there's some bound where the number is solid. Okay. Yeah, so even in the context of primordial black hole, yeah, I'm not presenting all of this because, I've just selected some results, but this is definitely a very nice result. Okay, so let's go now to first order phase transitions. Of course, we don't know whether we had first order phase transitions, right, in the early universe. We certainly know that we had the QCD and the electroweak one in the context of the standard model are crossovers, but they can get first order if we go beyond the standard paradigm. Or maybe we could also have phase transitions at higher temperature, higher energy scales, connected, for example, to the presence of extra dimensions. You can have the phase transition corresponding to the radiant stabilizations in the Randall-Sundin model, for example. Or you can have phase transitions. So now it is nowadays quite fashionable to study this mechanism is in which there is a sector which is uncoupled to the standard model sector, and this is used to get dark matter candidates that are then only gravitationally coupled to the standard model. So in this new particle physics sector, you could get, for example, first order phase transitions that you can probe with the gravitational emission, etc. So there are possibilities. So basically what happens, you get this nucleation of bubbles of the true vacuum. And then all the gravitational wave production takes place when this bubble rapidly expand and collide. Because then in this case, we have actually the three things I was telling you before are realized as an active source. So first of all, we have gradients in the scalar field, right? This is just a gradient in the scalar field that goes from true vacuum to false vacuum. We also have a bulk velocity because these bubbles expand in the early universe plasma. If you assume that the phase transition, which is a good assumption, takes place in a thermal environment, and obviously there is going to be particles of the plasma that are coupled to the scalar field which is undergoing the phase transition, like in the Higgs phase. And therefore this would set up, the coupling would set up the motion of the fluid as the wall sweeps through. And in particular, you can get production of sound waves and production of turbulent motions in the fluid that are also sources of gravitational waves.
So can I ask, is gamma, is it some sort of a viscosity or?
Gamma? No, this is the Lorentz factor. Oh. Yeah, it's just, you know, this is just the energy momentum tensor, enthalpy, velocity, Lorentz factor. I think your question is related to the fact that indeed you can model the fact that the expansion of the bubble walls produce bulk motion in the surrounding fluid by inserting an effective friction term between the scalar field and the fluid. As maybe you had this in mind. This is not this one. Okay, and then at last one can have magnetic fields, as we have seen, right, by the talk a few days ago, because basically what happens is that whatever you have this bulk motion in a fluid which is fully ionized, and so you generate currents, and if the currents are vertical, you can produce electromagnetic fields.
Please. You remember the gravitational wave scattering is very different from the sound wave and turbulence contribution. How do you see that?
No, you cannot see it from here. This is all very generic. I just put, I'm just flashing ideas. I show you a result for a spectrum later. Okay, so this is just to show you that first order phase transition has a very rich phenomenology for gravitational wave production. Okay, and then the nice thing is actually here you see the gravitational wave amplitude as a function of frequency. This is the LISA sensitivity curve in red. And as I told you, there is this best sensitivity around the millihertz. And turns out, following this relation that I was showing you before, right, basically this relation that modulo your epsilon, millihertz means around the TeV scale, which means that LISA can pick up the signal, the potential gravitational wave signal from electric phase transition in models beyond the standard model at an interesting energy scale for us, so the electric energy scale, right? So we can have a connection with models leading to biral symmetry or to dark matter candidates. So as we have seen also in the talk by Michael a couple of days ago, we could use LISA as a probe of beyond standard model physics complementary to next generation colliders. So here I'm just flashing one example of a gravitational wave signal. The black is the total, and see here I have decomposed it in two possible components, sound waves and turbulence, that as you were mentioning do have different spectral shapes.
I'm not sure, one turbulence along with a sound wave, and then there's another turbulence.
No. So this is there is sound waves, there is magneto hydrodynamic turbulence, and there are primordial magnetic fields. Okay, so you could have production by turbulence, turbulent velocity field configuration, and the turbulence produces electromagnetic field because it occurs in a fully ionized plasma, so it is MHD turbulence. Therefore, you have the presence of magnetic fields that are another source, by themselves, another source of gravitational waves. You can then say that since these electromagnetic fields, or better say magnetic fields, are generated by the turbulence, their energy density will be in equipartition with the kinetic energy density of the turbulence. Okay, so this, they are not independent, these two sources, and they are actually, we expect that they have comparable amplitudes. But the spectral shapes can be different.
There are no curves for the bubble collision, it's just that subdominant?
In this case, it is subdominant. Yeah, so basically, whenever you have surface. So bubble collision is can be the dominant contribution when all the rest is not around, meaning when the phase transition is very, very strong and effectively occurs in vacuum. And so there is no bulk motion, etc. But for a normal case, usually it is the bulk motion which is the dominant contribution, simply because it is around for longer time. Okay. So these are plots, just as always flashing examples. So here are, as you have already seen, these are the two possible parameters classifying your phase transition. Alpha is the strength, so basically the amount of latent heat with respect to the radiation energy density in the universe. And beta over H is the duration of the phase transition with respect to the Hubble time, inverse duration. So these curves here are the LISA, the regions that can be tested by LISA with signal to noise ratio 1, 5, 10, etc. And the points here are benchmark points for a scenario, which is basically what Michael was describing two days ago. So in which you have a singlet, a scalar singlet coupled to the Higgs. And here is if you, depending on the mixing angle, that's it. So if you have a quite big mixing angle, then you have the orange points that can be tested in some cases both by LHC and LISA. And if you have a small mixing angle, then you have the blue points that can be tested only by LISA. And in this case, you introduce a Z2 symmetry in the singlet, and this somehow prevents you to have a mixing with the Higgs field, and therefore you can only probe with LISA. There is no signature at LHC in this case. But just to mention that, you know, that there are scenarios that can actually give signatures in both cases. And within the cosmology working group, we have actually put online this tool, a web tool that allows you, if you have a favorite model for your phase transition, you specify the wall velocity, the temperature, number of degrees of radiation, degrees of freedom, etc., and it will produce a plot like this.
Jared, I guess just the takeaway from the plot is that I need the latent heat to be at least 10% of the
indeed
radiation energy density at the time of the phase transition.
Absolutely, to be able to see it with LISA.
I guess generically that would be challenging at the electric debuff, right? Is that fair to say, right?
Yeah, indeed. You see, yeah.
Radiation. Yeah, I see.
Exactly. Most of the models, they actually lie down here at low latent heat and long, short phase transitions. So you need to get strong and low phase slow phase transition to get something visible.
So the spectrum itself is well characterized by those parameters, or
the tell? Yeah. So alpha and beta, they both enter into the amplitude of the peak,
yeah,
while beta and the temperature enter into the location of the peak.
Yeah, what I'm concerned is when we look at this relation with the model, there seems to be quite similar parameters.
Oh, yeah.
We
absolutely
can distinguish more by looking at whole spectrum.
We won't be able to. So it's going to be difficult, really. I'm getting to that.
Yeah, I'd like to discuss sort of, I mean, if I kept the model, the parameters more or less similar, but I changed just the temperature of the phase transition.
Yeah, this is just shifting.
Shifted, but not the amplitude. The amplitude remains more or less.
Yeah, the amplitude remains the same.
Okay.
I think that maybe I should speed up. How much time do I have?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe.
Oh, God. I'm sorry, I really...
People can leave. Yeah, you can keep going. People can just leave. Yeah.
Okay, but I will try to be faster now for the... okay, so another possibility that I mentioned, so before it was first order phase transition, we can have a gravitational signal for cosmic strings as well. in this case, so we have a phase transition that produces this kind of defects. So and then you have here you have the image of a simulation of a cosmic string network. So cosmic string will generate loops by when they interconnect, they chop off loop, and these loops, it is believed that when they oscillate, they emit gravitational waves in a particular model. Okay, so here you see the long strings and the small loops that populate your universe. The results for gravitational wave production are very model dependent, but in general, one can say something that in a particular, so in general, if you have gravitational wave production, then you classify your cosmic string network with the tension of the strings, and this is related to the energy scale at which the phase transition is taking place. So this tells you whether or not you can detect it, and this tells you therefore which energy scale you are probing. And this is the result in the case of Nambu-Goto local strings. Okay, so it is a very specific scenario. For which the gravitational reproduction is the maximal, or is believed to be the maximal possible. We have omega as again as a function of frequency. This is the laser sensitivity. This is Fussell timing arrays. And this is the spectrum from the strings network for different values of the string tension, and therefore different values of the energy density of the energy scale of the phase transition. And you see Lisa can go down to G mu of order 10 to the minus 17, which is a few orders of magnitude better than whatever can be done by CDMOS or the SKA, Pulsar timing array using the SKA. So it has a great potential to test this kind of scenarios, meaning that it can test phase transitions occurring at lower and lower scales with respect to CMB or SKA. Okay, and this goes back a little bit back to your question of the shape of the spectrum. This is what we also developed in the context of the cosmology working group. So here I'm just flashing with some results. This is, by the way, the one by primordial black holes that I was discussing before from this paper. So you see the point is, okay, what do we do with this? Suppose we turn on the instrument and we see something. How can we assess what is the source? And the question is, and the answer is, okay, we need to find the best characterization possible of the shape of the signal. Without that, you cannot go anywhere to reconstruct what is your source. And so we developed a code which basically divide is the laser sensitivity range in beams, in frequency beams, and in each beam it fits just for an amplitude and a slope. And then you put the beam together and you characterize your detailed shape. Okay. And this is, for example, this is an injected signal that has this bump like this and two power laws, and the code performs the reconstruction of the signal. And this is, for example, what the code can do for a completely crazy signal, which is oscillating, you see, but when you decompose it in a sufficiently dense number of beams, and you are able to recharacterize the amplitude and the slope in each beam, then you might be able to reconstruct the spectrum.
What will the data look like? Will there be these big bins in the data?
This blue thing is the data.
But I mean, the actual, whenever?
No, the bins are decided by the code.
So, 20 years from now, will I be seeing this plot with actual data on it with big error bars? Or, I mean, I guess I'm asking about what will the actual error bars
look like. The blue thing, the blue is the simulation
of the data. Blue is the simulation of the data.
Basically, so the data is obviously a stream in time of H stream. Okay, then you can turn it into omega as a function of frequency. Mm-hmm. And you have something like the blue thing, in which we also introduce the instrumental noise.
So the thickness of the band here would correspond to uncertainties.
Exactly, this I didn't mention, sorry. So in each bin, the code fits for four parameters. Two are the noise of the instrument, and two are the amplitude and the slope of the signal. So.
I see. And does LIGO have a code like this? Are they considering similar analysis?
No, they always just fit one slope.
Power law across.
Yeah, a power law across the whole frequency range.
What's the smoothness prior on this one? Do you treat it each bin independently, or do you cross-link and say that it cannot do crazy things?
No, it's each bin is independent.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically the bins are chosen depending on the signal to noise ratio.
It's literally like linear interpolation, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So not linear, really. It's a log-log code, so it's a power law on each bin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, linear and log-log.
So I think related to the previous question, I mean, is there a structure that can be read out of a time series of data? I mean, I just wonder how the signal really looks like in the detector, I mean, of a stochastic
wave.
I mean, do you have constant
noise? Imagine white noise.
Like, discrete events and separating.
No, planets. It will be from the early universe, or no, for also for astrophysics.
I mean, I understand that there's
constant noise.
The frequency is low, but okay.
Yeah, no, it is constant noise. That is there since you turn on your instrument, you get it. Okay, so the real point is to distinguish it from your instrumental noise. So you need a good model of the instrumental noise to be able to tell what is signal and what is noise. Otherwise, they just look the same. Because it is, provided they are both Gaussian noise, etc. But from the point of view of the time series, it is continuous.
But periodic in a sense, otherwise you wouldn't have power at
certain
frequencies.
Sorry?
Yeah. If you were to plot a time series in a periodogram or something like this, you would see power.
You would see. Yeah. Sorry. Oh, okay. Yeah. So of course here the amplitude of your signal is it will have harmonics in your time series. This I agree. But the point is that you cannot really pick it up. Looking at the time series, you need to transform. I don't know if you agree, but
You mean specifically for this signal? No, just general, because that's a somewhat curious.
That's
just wonder how analysis to cost the stochastic signal.
I think maybe if you'd have something like this, with an extremely sharp peak, maybe this would. Look as a particular pattern that is repeating on a given time scale, but
you still won't expect it to be coherent, I don't think.
No, indeed. Because the characteristic coherence on the time scale is settled by the Hubble time at the source. Okay, so it is tiny.
No, but this is assuming you have just your instrument noise plus one source of signal. I mean, in reality, I can assume there'll be like astrophysical.
It doesn't matter, because here you just fit in each bin, you fit one amplitude and one
slope.
Sure.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact that this comes from one source, we don't know. Maybe one bump comes from some astrophysical
Absolutely.
Process, right? So essentially,
we will get
one waveform and then we'll have to
figure out one model
or is it like 10 models on top of each other?
Absolutely. Okay, so now...
That's multiple steps, I guess. So you remove the waveforms at the level of the time stream, and then you take the power spectrum. So you don't do the Fourier transform of the whole time stream, because then you have your sources in there that you would want to take out at the level of the time stream.
Yeah, okay. But if you can distinguish the sources. I can imagine those, like, there are so too many sources that at some point they become a background. Or something.
Oh, yeah, the unresolved sources are still in there.
Okay.
And so those, I don't know, usually they're modeled in some way, in some...
Yeah.
Some ideas for what they
Either, for example, if they are stick to the galactic plane, if they are galactic binaries, for example, they will have a time modulation due to the fact that LISA is turning.
So
you might be able to use that. If it is black holes or neutron star outside the galaxy, then you have a prediction for the spectral shape.
So you can start making this sort of...
Yeah, but you have to... Clear.
We sort of seen all of this in CMB except in two dimensions, so it's very close, right? You know, that's the answer how this would look like. You know, you look at CMB, it looks like noise. If there is a particular, like, you know, frequency you're talking about, that's baryon acoustic peak or something, you will have, like, you know, the noise roughly clusters on like 1 degree scale. Here it would be on some time scale, right? And then, like, unresolved pointers and stuff like that, we also see on the maps, like, you know, you can go, like, to, let's say, high frequency, which has lots of point sources, you take them all out and then take a Fourier transform and suddenly you still end up power corresponding to power sources. Basically means some of them are hiding in the noise. So like entire, like, you know, this story like would be exactly sort of, you know, reproduced. And the stochastic signal would be very hard to separate from normal noise. The only way I'll believe it is probably if it cross correlates on two detectors as opposed to...
If we can do in space, obviously, yeah.
Yeah.
No, really, you need a model of the noise before the instrument flies with some error bars, and then on which you are confident. Okay, so now I swear I'm only taking just really 5 minutes to tell you about the late time universe very fast. Okay, so it is standard silence, right? Which, what does it mean? It means that if you, so this is now, now, so I switch topics, it's not any longer a stochastic background, now this is the signal from the gravitational wave strain from a binary, compact binary. And we have the two polarizations of the strain, and you see we can get out of the signal provided you do your parameter estimation pretty good. You can get out the luminosity distance of the source in the sky. And the luminosity distance depends, so this is obviously the gravitational wave luminosity distance, not the electromagnetic one. They might differ in some exotic theories, but. So as you know, the luminosity distance then depends on the geometry of the universe, so not only on the redshift, but also on the cosmological parameter, H0, omega matter, omega lambda, etc. Which means that from gravitational waves, you might get an handle to the cosmological parameters. And what is very good about gravitational waves is that you get this luminosity distance very clearly. You see, it is just one other parameter, like the chirp mass or the orientation of the binary plane. You don't need to do cross correlation of you know, cephades with supernovae with whatever to get your distance. So this is the good point about gravitational waves. Now the bad point is that there is nowhere here that there is an extra dependence on redshift. So if you want to get out the cosmological parameters, you need both an independent measurement of the redshift and of the luminosity distance, and you cannot get the redshift out of gravitational waves only. And therefore, you need an independent measurement of the redshift by an electromagnetic counterpart or some other method.
Yeah, sorry. But for the chirp mass, you can get it from the frequency? Or I mean, how are you going to separate the chirp mass from the distance?
Here you have your waveform, and you do a model parameter estimation on your waveform signal. The signal depends on whatever 10 or 11 parameters, okay, and you extract all of them. And one of them is the L, and one of them is the chirp mass, etc. But definitely there is no redshift in this. Okay, so this is what one aims to reconstruct. So the luminosity distance as a function of redshift, the blue line is lambda CDM. This is a fake plot, okay, it's not real data, obviously. But it's just to show you what LISA could see. So at high redshift here, we have the binaries of massive black holes which are believed to be, or we hope are, in the center of galaxies. So we know there are massive black holes in the center of galaxies. We haven't observed a binary yet. LISA will be able to get these kind of sources with very high signal-to-noise ratio if they are in the right ballpark for the masses, which means less than 10 to the 7 solar masses.
So massive black holes is different to supermassive black holes, or are these the supermassive?
Well, supermassive in general is the 10 to the 9 solar masses, like this. This LISA won't see. So these are for pulsar timing arrays. LISA sees 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 solar masses, up to 10 to the 7 solar masses.
Is there other models of how these are distributed? You said these are expected in the center of galaxies.
Exactly. So
these are orbiting the supermassive black holes?
I think it hijacked the ideas.
Exactly. They have these simulations. So this is really, it's difficult physics, and they're very model dependent, so we don't really know what is going on.
So this is why you expect them to work.
Yeah. You have the merger of galaxies, and you hope that the two black holes get together and go in a bound orbit and then merge.
Would LISA see individual events or see some sort of stochastic
stuff? Here is really individual events. That's why you can actually get out the parameters, otherwise it would be difficult.
But we expect a result.
These ones are the results.
Oh.
Yeah, I have maybe other plots that I can show you later about. Okay, so, and these black hole binaries, they are at quite high redshift. Okay, so this depends on the model of the galaxy mergers and how the black hole accrete in the galaxy. So it is really there is a lot of model building going on, but we expect them to be the bulk of it higher than redshift 1.
So it looks like LISA might actually provide information on the scenarios behind this, right? It's still an unknown.
Absolutely.
The mechanism, right, that really is congenital.
Yeah, this is the main part of the science case for LISA, is to probe the formation of massive black holes in the center of galaxies. I'm not talking about that because I'm not an astrophysicist, but all this that I'm presenting is a side effect of whenever they decided to build LISA to get these guys. Yeah, because this signal-to-noise ratio is like up to 1,000 or whatever.
That means they're going to find cosmic strings, because it's clearly cosmic strings which are responsible.
Okay, we have here another kind of source, which is extreme mass ratio in spirals. In this case, it is a small compact object, like a neutron, like a black hole or a neutron star, which is orbiting and merging into one of those guys. So we don't need to have at the center of galaxies a binary of black holes. So you can have just our own galaxy, for example, with its Sagittarius A and an object which is merging into it. LISA could pick it up. And the other thing, LISA could possibly pick it up, these two with much lower signal-to-noise ratio than this, is the collision, is the binaries of black holes of stellar mass of the type that LIGO and Virgo are seeing, though this is in spiral phase. So they are in spiraling, and then after 10, whatever, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, they merge in the LIGO band, so LISA will be able to see them before.
So could you have a situation where you could actually predict when someone's going to have?
Indeed. Absolutely. That's one thing. It would be possible to say.
Actually, it's going to be 5 years later.
Yeah, like 5 years later, but you say 5 years with a precision of 0.1 seconds. It's really, really the problem is then to coordinate the clocks to the precision.
Can you say, you're going to say the next line, what is the angular resolution? Because if I want to see the counterparts for this far,
a disaster. The angular resolution is a disaster.
I will show you.
So in principle you can use all these sources to build this luminosity distance versus redshift plot. However, you expect counterparts only for these guys here, because this is black hole mergers all alone. We don't expect a counterpart, and Emrys, we don't expect a counterpart either. Here, they merge in a disk at the center of the galaxy, so you do expect a counterpart. For these low redshift sources, the cool thing is that one can do identification without counterpart with a statistical technique that I can explain maybe later, but I think we need to speed up. So also because for now we did the analysis also only with these sources, and this is the result, pretty bad actually. So you see, this is the number of events as a function of rest shift that are expected in LISA for different scenarios of these massive black hole binary formation. So you see the bulk of the sources goes from 1 to 5 in redshift. These are black hole mergers for which we simulated the presence of a visible counterpart. Okay, so these are really standard signs expected for LISA. And for this, for example, we require the sky localization to be better than 10 square degrees. So it is really huge, but the hope is that then these sources will do a transient that the electromagnetic telescope can identify. Okay. So it is not based on the localization that you can associate the electromagnetic emission of these guys to the gravitational wave emission. So with that, you see that the bound on H is... I mean, we can do something, but it's not competitive to whatever is done even today. But we can get something, you know, some interesting constraint on modified gravity theories. This is just one example in which you have this term here in the damping term. And therefore, these terms, with this term, you get that the luminosity distance in gravitational waves is different than the one for the electromagnetic waves, and therefore this is something that only LISA could see, for example. Okay, and I finished. This was my last plot. So the conclusion is that I hope I convinced you that LISA is a good mission to test cosmology.
Trying to understand this stellar mass black hole binaries. So, I mean, LISA turns on, and now I'm imagining that it's hearing all of the stellar mass black hole binaries that LIGO will see in the next 10 years or something. Is that the right picture?
Not all. Okay. So.
And I mean, I guess the question is about, is that going to lead some kind of confusion if I'm trying to extract the stochastic background signal?
Indeed. So, okay, we expect these kind of sources to produce a stochastic background as well in LISA. And we expect some of them to be individually detectable. The number of exactly how many of them will be individually detectable is not clear yet. Okay. We are doing the analysis.
Okay. And the order of magnitude?
The order of magnitude, so according to whatever I did with collaborations, is like 100.
Okay.
There are other people who say zero.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, but, so we really need to pin down all these numbers correctly. And then of these that LISA will see with high enough signal-to-noise ratio to individually see them, some will merge in LISA band, in the LIGO band. Some will just, you know, continue in spiral for 100 years, and in this case we don't.
But suppose that LISA is hearing 100 of these things. Is there some way to extract that out of the data in order to get at the stochastic, the primordial stochastic background? I mean, can I?
So, those that LISA can see individually can be subtracted by the data stream. Those that LISA that don't have a high enough signal to noise ratio to be seen individually cannot be subtracted, and they do a background. The only way in which this background could be distinguished is by the frequency shape, the spectral shape. I don't think there is any other technique to be able to allow to subtract this foreground. But
could you imagine, I guess, observing them with LIGO later on and measuring the parameters and then going back?
Indeed. It has been proposed, not with Einstein Telescope or Cosmic Explorer, you know, you know, for this, one needs to be sure that they have high enough signal-to-noise ratio in Cosmic Explorer and not in LISA. So it has to be worked out properly.
This is related to Andrew's question. So we know there will be astrophysical foregrounds and stochastic background. So if you pull out your signal above the instrument noise, has anyone explored how your modeling of the foregrounds actually lets you go after primordial signals? Because, you know, of course, if the peak's in the middle, that's probably like the optimal thing to do. But if you start to shift the peak of your signal, it's just like a power law that's effectively, you have to marginalize over your foregrounds on that anyway.
Indeed.
I'm we knowing need how CMB much degradation you're going to get
to teach
point.
Us, I think, how to do it. Because in the LISA, at least in the LISA cosmology group, we don't have real expertise on how to solve the foreground subtraction, if there is a way to do it.
That's the point. Somebody mentioned to me doing sort of an annular modulation effect where in the course of a year or something.
This is just for the sources that are in the galaxy plane.
Is that actually something that did I make that up in a dream or somebody on the collaboration told me that?
I think it is possible. It is possible, but this is only the binaries that are in the galactic binaries, which, you know, there are a lot of them and they're visible by LISA, so it is important that we are able to subtract that. But it is not the totality of the binaries of the sources. There was maybe Ed.
I've asked way too many.
About the foreground estimate, there's a stellar mass black hole and a massive black hole and something in the middle. Can you comment on which population is more important in terms of the estimate of the foreground? And for the stellar mass, you probably can extrapolate from LIGO.
Yeah, so.
How much you would add on to that? Is model dependent?
I think it depends. So you say what population is the more important from which point of view? From the point of view of whatever LISA can detect, or from the point of view of getting cosmological parameters?
I mean, I think for the primordial signal you need, there's a foreground from this unresolved astrophysics events, right? So they have some limits already and they pay.
Massive black holes, yeah, they don't give a foreground.
Right, they don't give, but I guess it's model dependent, but it is how much it can get, can enhance relative to what you can extrapolate from LIGO.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So LIGO has already limits on the subjective background from the astrophysics.
Exactly.
Part, and then you can extrapolate to the lower frequency.
Exactly. So,
but they didn't consider the massive black hole contribution, I suppose.
So
they just, what in principle can add, I mean, maybe that just
underestimate.
It is how much they can get.
Yeah. So, okay. So the massive black holes, they are not going to give a stochastic background in the LISA band. Okay, they give a stochastic background in the pulsar timing array band. So concerning massive black hole binaries, we are clean. Okay, what can give a background in the LISA band are stellar origin black holes, neutron star binaries, or in general white dwarfs, and this extreme mass ratio in spirals. This is one compact object, a few stellar masses, or 10 stellar masses, merging into a big black hole at the center of the galaxy, merging into a black hole of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 solar masses.
Can we get information about this extreme, the middle region?
Yeah, in principle, we don't know how many there are. Actually, it is very uncertain the rate of this kind of sources, but we do expect to see them in LISA.
Do you expect it to maybe much more than what you can extrapolate?
The fact is, you don't extrapolate. So let's consider the stellar mass black holes, which is the simplest candidate. So for this, what you need to evaluate the stochastic background, you need to know the population of these guys as a function of redshift, as a function of mass, the mass distribution, etc. And once you have this population, you build the waveforms that you expect, and then you simulate your data stream in LISA with all these waveforms, one over the other, and then you start performing parameter estimation on the those that are they have the highest signal to noise ratio. You subtract them, and then you rebuild your noise curve, okay? And you subtract those that are a bit lower signal to noise ratio, and et cetera, et cetera. And you subtract them all until you get to the contribution of those that you can't subtract because they have signal to noise ratio which is too low. This is the residual background that you have in the instrument by this kind of source. Okay, so it is not an extrapolation. You need to calculate it properly to be able to assess what is the level of the stochastic background due to this kind of sources in the LISA band. And to do this calculation, you need as input the population model, which you get out from LIGO, Virgo.
But for the EMRI, you don't get
an input? From the EMRIs, you have no clue how many are there.
What is
the
extreme mass ratio in spiral?
Extreme mass ratio.
Yeah.
So one big one, small.
They're all diverged from
one big one, small.
Exactly. So one black hole at the center of a galaxy with a small one orbiting around. For those, the population of those is highly unconstrained. So this is just, you know, put some data there, but we really don't know whether there is one or 50,000. So it is difficult.
So the problem, I guess, is that the frequency goes up as you approach the merger, and the bigger it is, the earlier they merge. So these ones, you never see them in LIGO, in the LIGO band.
Although indeed, indeed, it is, yeah,
so
absolutely.
You have to extrapolate from LIGO because they just merged before already.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, indeed, this you don't get in LIGO.
So they can possibly contribute more stochastic background
than the stellar mass. We don't know.
How far away can you see white dwarf mergers? You know, if you have a white dwarf,
The white dwarfs are too low. Too low signal to noise ratio. You don't get them. Apart from the galaxy one, the extra galactic one, they don't disturb the
I think there's a lesson that has been learned from LIGO that hasn't been learned yet because you haven't got any data coming in. But I don't think with LIGO, when I heard LIGO talks, I didn't hear people saying we're expecting to pick up black hole binaries is the dominant thing. The thing that they were expecting was neutron star.
Yeah, indeed.
And in fact, they've only found one of them. I mean, I think they've been surprised, taken by surprise. So the rest of it is there's going to be some kind of fascinating things out there that is going to happen. But
it could very well be. It could very well be. Yeah.
Predicting future is tricky business.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had Jim Huff give a talk the year that these were discovered, that the black holes were. And I was asking, what are you expecting? And he said, well, we're not expecting anything yet. We haven't got the sensitivity yet to get the neutron star black holes, and that's what we all expect.
And yeah, absolutely. We don't know.
So I just have one query about. So there have been papers out saying that this is going to be a great way to determine H naught, and indeed, with it's just given the dependence on the luminosity distance, and that looks very promising. But the number of events that you were showing seems to be the downside.
Indeed, so
we just don't get enough events to actually get decent statistics.
Yeah, so the papers, I don't know which papers you're referring to, but I think these are papers for LIGO Virgo. Yeah. For LISA, we don't know what, maybe we could do something nice with these sources. The analysis has not been done. But concerning massive black hole binaries, the numbers are not good enough.
I mean, I think there's different ways of looking at it. But I mean, on the one hand, you can be disappointed that you're not measuring H naught very well. But on the other hand, I think you should really take the opposite perspective and be excited that you're really getting a measurement of the luminosity distance.
Exactly.
Or which is independent, which is knowledge of seconds or tip of the ring.
And now, so what we are doing, preparing now, is a paper in which we, instead of, you know, giving as a thing that you can measure omega m, omega lambda today or h naught today, what we try to assess is if whether you can measure h at redshift 2 and how well. And this is where these will make the difference, absolutely.
Oh, it's okay, great.
Yeah.
To see some evidence of evolution,
right? Yeah, but the preliminary results tell us that actually you need to do, I mean, so we tried a completely agnostic approach in which we just, you know, reduce the redshift range and we fit a linear relation for h, for the, it is the derivative actually of h to z, to z that you can observe, and apparently you see nothing. But if you assume that you are matter dominated, then you can get out the value of h with Lisa, the value of h at redshift 2 or 3, with this extra assumption of matter domination. I know it's maybe not, but still, I mean.
What's the level of precision you expect for
H? I don't want to tell you because I don't know. No, it's not that. No.
Because the redshift range is still have galaxy surveys. So there's HETX, for example, is looking for laminar diameters, which is supposed to measure PAO in that.
Exactly.
So there you expect it still to get a percent-ish error bars on H.
Which is great because we could maybe combine, you know, maybe we have different degeneracies, I don't know. So, and the precision, so because the analysis up to now, it's very preliminary and it is done only with the in spiral phase for the massive black hole binaries. But we expect that if we are able to model merger ring down, it will increase the number of standard signs that we expect. So I don't want to say 10% or 0.1% yet. I would like to see really what is the final, I mean, using all the weight.
Also the massive black hole, I mean, those ones are going out to higher redshift, right? So you get constraints where you wouldn't really expect them from redshift surveys.
Yeah, but the numbers, yeah, but you see, you cannot do much. So if you take, for example, this model, which is one of the most pessimistic, with two sources, you cannot do much here. So that's why we choose two as a benchmark. Three would work as well. But you need to be with either two or three. Because here it's really too many, too few sources to do something. And this is also an old plot. We need to redo it. No, actually no. This is already with the last LISA configuration, so it's okay.
3.8% is the average over redshift.
What do you mean? This is the error, one sigma error. On H naught.
What redshift or average?
This is today. H naught today. So it is really not what we are talking about now. This is the old analysis. This analysis that has been done in this paper, which concentrated actually on modified gravity. So we are redoing this for the standard cosmological model, proposing a figure of merit which is H at redshift 2 or 3.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.